Okay, now without further ado, I'd like to introduce Catherine.
Just throwing stuff on the floor up here, I'll be fine. Okay. Hi, I'm Kathy. I'm a very grateful member of the Al-Anon Fellowship. I want to thank you all first for helping us celebrate our birthday. That was really a cool gift, because our birthday celebrations in our meetings back in Gardena and Torrance are the last week of the month. And so this is like a real super-duper deal to be able to celebrate it this early in the month. My Al-Anon birthday is January 3rd, so I am here. I am really, really in Al-Anon 25 years. I just told you my home group is the Torrance Podium Participation Group, not easy to say, and we meet on Monday nights, and I also attend a Thursday night women's stag, which we call ourselves Focus on Feelings, and because who had those when we got here, right? No one was willing to admit they had any feelings. I know I certainly wasn't, other than being pissed off, like I told you earlier. I want to thank Steve for inviting me to come. I know I'm the second pick. Kathy S. was supposed to be here with you tonight, but she's doing some service work, and so he called Kathy W. instead. And so here I am. I told you my home group. I told you my serenity date. My sponsor's name is Mary Pearl T. from North Little Rock, Arkansas. And we have a long distance sponsorship relationship, and I call her every Thursday night and in between if necessary, and we stay online with each other. And so that sponsorship is based on full honesty, full disclosure, because it's real easy to lie to somebody over the phone. You know, and I found out that I had to stay true and honest all the time. And honesty was not my strong suit when I got here. I lied if the truth would work. You know, seriously, I made stuff up as I went along. I was just kicking along. Anything that you said worked for me, you know. And I didn't have a favorite color. I didn't know what I liked, you know. Whatever your opinion was my opinion. And that's how it was when I got here. But that's not how it is today, and I'm grateful for that. Today I have strong opinions that some people don't agree with. And I'm really grateful to my husband for coming out with me tonight. It was really fun to celebrate our birthday together. So how does it start? It starts with being raised in an alcoholic family. My father drank every day. My mother screamed every day. Both of them died without the benefit of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon. Literally, Dad would, you know, drink every day, and when he came rolling through the door, 5 minutes after my mother called the bar, and they said he wasn't there, had not been there, just had left, he'd come ripping in the door, and she would start in with what we call the Polish Inquisition, because we're Polish. At least the kids, my sisters and brother and I would call it the Polish Inquisition. She would say, "Where have you been?" And he would try to buy a little time to come up with a good answer by repeating the question, "Where have I been? Have you been drinking? Have I been drinking? How much have you had to drink? How much have I had to drink?" You know, I'm just like, oh my Lord. And us kids were rolling on the floor, and she had those pursed purple little lips, you know. She was not having any of it. She was a very unhappy woman, very unhappy. She was a rageaholic, there's no question about it. She'd hit you with anything she could lay her hands on. Today I know I was an abused child. Back then it was just called punishment. You know, I mean, anything she could lay her hands on. So in any case, early on, I made a decision that I was not ever going to marry anybody like my dad or ever become like my mother. God forbid. You know, that just wasn't going to happen. And I was going to marry somebody and get out of that house as soon as I could. You know, it's just like, oh, I don't want to live here anymore. This is insanity. And so while I was in high school, you know, I had my feelers out. I dated one guy all through high school. I thought eventually I'd end up marrying him. My mother told me I better not. He was from a family of 13 children, and she most certainly did not want 13 grandchildren. What made her think that I would do something like that? And so, but what she did tell me is that, you know, I was never ever to go down to the corner of 22nd and Sheridan. I lived right outside the main gate of the Great Lakes Naval Training Center. And that's where the main gate was. And so, you know, in my search for the man of my dreams, there were a plethora of choices down there on 22nd and Sheridan. And I wasn't a child to obey the rules all the time. And so when she said, don't go down there, that's where I went. And we called that scooping the loop. And when I was down there scooping one night, I scooped somebody up. He jumped in my car, and we saw each other for a couple of weeks, and he asked me to marry him, and I was ready. This was going to be it, you know. But what happened was he got sent over to Yokosuka, Japan, and while he was gone, somebody else asked me to marry him, and so I married him. Because it wasn't about a long-term relationship. It wasn't about love. It wasn't about commitment. It was about getting out of the house. Now, I have learned since I've been in the program that I could have moved out of the house. That never occurred to me. We're talking about the mid-60s, Vietnam's going on, you know. If you're 18 years old and unmarried, you're a spinster for crying out loud, you know. So this was my chance. This guy asked me to marry him, and I said I would. And while we were being engaged for a few months, he joined the Army, and he joined because he was going to get drafted, and he didn't want to go to Vietnam. So he wanted to choose his own MOS, and so he went on down to Kentucky to his basic training. And when that was over, the day before we were to get married, I flew down to be with him for his graduation. By then I knew that I was 5.5 months pregnant with his child, and had not told anybody. Nobody. My mom didn't know. Nobody knew. The OBGYN knew, and that was it. And when I got down there, he said to me, you know, I've changed my mind. Oh no, oh no, you have not. You don't understand. You know, my mom is the queen of control, and she's got 300 people coming to a sit-down dinner tomorrow night, and you're damn well going to be there. And he said, well, I haven't even had my blood test, so we can't get our marriage license. And I just thought, you know, I'll figure this out. And we got on the plane, and we flew back to Illinois, and his brother-in-law was a chief in the Navy, and I said to his brother-in-law, he hasn't got his blood tested, we got to get our marriage license in the morning, and we still got to be at church by 10:30. And he said, no problem. And he took him down to the Navy base, and he talked to some poor corpsman and said, you're going to take this guy's blood, you're going to write down that you took it yesterday, and you're going to write down that it's okay. And the corpsman said, yes, sir. And at 9:30 in the morning, we were in the courthouse, and at 10:30 in the morning, I was coming down the aisle on my father's arm, and I know he was thinking in the front of the church, wait, I told her no yesterday. You know, why is she coming down the aisle? There it is. There it is. So anyways, down the aisle I came, and we went off to our first duty station, which was in Huntsville, Alabama. And that baby was born right on time, but she was born dead. And I had a break with the higher power that I had grown up with at that point that was not to be healed until I came to these rooms. Mom always said, naughty girls always get hurt. God's going to get you for that. And I decided that God had killed my baby because I had committed the big sin. You know, I was pregnant before I got married. Bad news. And so in any case, his next duty station was in New Jersey someplace, and I got pregnant right away. I was pregnant immediately. And when we got to New Jersey, we found out that the nearest Army hospital was 75 miles away, and I was in a lot of fear about what was going to happen with this baby. And so I went home to stay with my mom during that pregnancy. And I can tell you that I knew he drank. I knew he was a drinker. But at that point, it was really not a problem. I didn't see it as a problem. It certainly didn't match up with my dad's drinking. You know, there wasn't anything as bad as that. You know, so I wasn't concerned about it. And I had that baby while he went off to Germany. And that was a big old 9-pound, 3.5-ounce boy. He was a good boy, I'll tell you. And then I went over to Germany to be with him after I had that baby. And there I noticed that he was doing some drinking. You know, we went to the guest houses, and he was drinking pretty heavy, but it wasn't anything that I didn't feel like I could manage. And I need to tell you that I'm a Catholic, and so Catholics, you know, have sex before marriage, but we don't use birth control. And so, and so I got pregnant again when I was in Germany. And so I came home just before that baby was to be born, because my husband was to be getting out of the service at that time, and had another, this time, 8 pounds, 3.5 ounce boy. And so they're getting smaller as we go along. And so, and so he came home, and something drastically changed when he came home. He, you know, when he was in the Army, they told him where to go, what to wear, what time to be there, what to do while he was there, what time to go home, and when to come back. And when he came home from the Army, there was nobody to tell him to do that. And so he was kind of running amok. So I appointed myself to be the person to do that for him. Tell him where to go, what to wear, what to do when he got there, when to come home, and when to go back. Only he didn't do that. He would come home with somebody else's paint on the side of our car. He would come home without the paycheck. He would call me from the train station and say, "I don't know where I left the car. You're on the train." You know, what's going on here? Or he'd call me from a bar and say, "I don't know where I am. Come and get me." And I'd say, "Put down the phone, go to the front of the building, look at the name on the front, come back in and tell me the name on the front." And I could hear him do it. He'd put down the phone, he'd walk over, he'd walk out there, and boom, 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 he'd come back, and he'd say, "I'm at Frank's." And I'd say, "Okay, just stay put, I'm coming to get you." And so I'd go to Frank's to pick him up, and when I brought him home, I had the girl that was living in the apartment across the hall from me standing at the foot of the stairs with a camera so she could take his picture and I could show him what he looked like when he came home like that. Thank you, Jack. And that's what I did, you know, and that didn't help. It didn't help. Take my word for that. But what I saw happening was I was morphing into my mother. And my God, I didn't want to do that. He was like my dad. He just wanted to come home, sneak in, lay down, be quiet, and not me. When my mouth was attached to that doorknob, and when he came in, I would start in and I'd say the same stupid stuff that my mom said to my dad. "Where have you been? Have you been drinking? How much have you had to drink?" And I'd have out-of-body experiences. I'd be standing over here going, "Shut up!" And I couldn't. I couldn't shut up. I just had to go for it. I had to go for it every single time. And so, what can I tell you? You know, I kind of became a loon. So we had another baby. And there's another boy. So now we got three little boys. And the girls in the apartment building are going, "Kathy, my God, you have got to get out. You're losing it. You know, all you're talking about is how to get the stains out of the diapers and what's going on with Barnabas Collins." Now, I don't know how many of you know, remember Dark Shadows, the original vampire, black and white. Okay, that's my man. And and that's all I ever talked about anymore. And they said, "You really need to get out." And so I said, "Okay, let's go out." And so they went bowling on Tuesday nights, and they invited me to go bowling with them. And so I said, "Okay, I'll go bowling." Well, I don't bowl. I didn't bowl then, and I don't bowl now. But I went bowling, and these gals would, you know, they'd be bowling, and I didn't have anything to do, but there was a lounge attached to the bowling alley. And so I'd go sit in the lounge. There was live music. There were men there whose wives didn't understand them. And, you know, and not through... I'm going to say through no fault of my own, but through every fault of my own, I started having overlapping relationships. I heard that from a speaker at the South Bay Roundup this year, and I stole it. I'm using it. Absolutely. It's much better than adulteress, you know. So anyway, I'm having a relationship outside of my marriage, and it's not enhancing my marriage in any way. And we get to a point to where we're talking about divorce, but my youngest sister's getting married and we don't want to louse up her wedding with divorce plans because we're both from big Catholic families. And we say, "Well, you know, we'll talk more about it after the wedding." And so the day of the wedding, I say to him, "Please, please, please come home on time. We got to get to the reception." And he said he would, but he came home late and he came home drunk, and I sloshed him up and down in the tub, and I got him, you know, to the wedding reception about 45 minutes late. And my middle sister was standing at the top of the stairs, and she's got her hands on her hips, and she says, "It's about damn time you got here." And I thought to myself, this bitch needs to die. she not see what was going on here? Okay, I got this drunk on one arm, these three little ankle biters on the other, and she's gonna say those seven words to me? Well, I formed a resentment for her that day that I carried for 17 years. And every time I had to talk to her, be around her, think about her, I nourished it. Boy, I put manure on that baby every chance I got. And it grew and grew and grew. In any case, if you take a drunk to a wedding, you're coming home with a drunker drunk. Chances are. And so I had brought the kids home earlier and had a friend over to keep the kids. And when we got home, we got into it. And he was kind of balling up his fist. And my friend thought he was going to hit me. So she called her husband. And he came over with a gun. I was ready to let him die. I was. But we had a gold carpet, and I didn't want any blood on my carpet. And so I asked Rick to take him outside to shoot him. And they went outside, and they had a man-to-man talk. And actually, he came in alive and well. And about two weeks later, he moved out. And that was fine with me. That was fine with me. But what happened then was, I was getting this little pittance of money for these three kids, and it wasn't enough to keep me going. And so I needed a job. And so I got a job at the Turf Club Lounge, right there where I was working, where I was going when I was supposed to be bowling. And there were lots of men in there whose wives didn't understand them, but it was a great job for somebody like me, because I like to take care of people. And I had my regulars. When they hit the door, I knew what they drank. It was on their table, and I was ready to roll at all times. And then, I would come home, and I would take my babysitter home and go out to some after hours place looking for the next him, And unfortunately, my kids at that time were left home alone. Home alone, ages 1, 2, and 3, while I was out carousing. And I've read in the newspaper and seen it. I heard it from a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous about, the three little kids burning up in the house while the mom was out doing whatever the mom was out doing. And I'm ever grateful today to say, that I had a higher power that I didn't even know keeping an eye on those kids and taking care of me. But then at the same time, I still didn't have enough money, so I started working a daytime job, and so I'd taken the kids to the babysitter during the day, and I'm bringing the babysitter in at night. And the second job, the daytime job, was a pretty darn good job. And three guys on motorcycles rolled in one day at that job, and I set my cap for one of them right now. I mean, the minute he walked through the door, I'm like, that's mine. Because I don't need to know you to love you. And so I actually told the woman across the desk from me, I'm going to marry that guy someday. And she just shook her head like she mostly did when I talked. And then I went about trying to figure out how to get him to talk to me. And I thought, what can I talk to him about? And I noticed that he wore a jingle bell around his neck on a chain. And I thought, I'll ask him about the jingle bell. And so, yeah. And so he came in the office one day and I said, so Les, what's that jingle bell about? And he said, ladies, I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did. He said, that's so you can find me when the lights go out. I'm telling you, I have not heard a better pickup line since. And so I started writing my name and phone number on a little piece of paper and handing it to everybody he worked with and saying, give this to the new guy in the warehouse. If you see the new guy in the warehouse, would you give him this? Give this piece of paper to the new guy in the warehouse. And he says he called me the first time because his pockets were bulging with little pieces of paper with my phone number on. And so I was, oh, yes. And he did. He called me and he asked me to go to a movie. Well, I had not been on a date for a really long time because if you took me someplace, generally you came home and you came in and you spent some time with me, be it a few hours or overnight, because all my self-esteem at that point was between the sheets. And if you slept with me, that meant you liked me, and that's all I really wanted was for somebody to like me. And he took me to a movie. The ever romantic movie Deliverance. And he brought me home and he kissed me goodnight at the door. And I thought, he doesn't even like me. He just kissed me goodnight and left. Well, they come to find out he was raised in Texas by a Southern mom who taught him that you kiss a girl goodnight on the first date and you go home. And he moved in 2 weeks later. And we had a wonderful relationship. And he had been on this motorcycle trip with these guys. They had gotten out of the Navy in Long Beach, and they had bought motorcycles, and they were taking a trip around the United States, and they got to the Chicago area and ran out of money and ran out of summer. And so they took these jobs where I was working, and now they were getting ready to finish their trip, go back to California. And did I want to go along? Oh, yes, this is my meal ticket out of this one-horse town. I got these three little kids, you know, and I need to get out of here. And so my lawyer says I have to ask my first husband, because my kids are wards of the court. I just have custody, and I can't just pick them up and leave with them. So I ask him, and he says no, under any circumstances. And then he forgot that he had said no to me once before, several years earlier, the day before our wedding. And so I just went back to the lawyer and said, now what do I do? And he goes, well, if you're married and your new husband is seeking employment, your first husband can't stop you. No problem. So I just come home and say, Les, we have to get married. And he says, okay, because he's a budding Al-Anon. He's ready. He's ripe for the picking. And so we have this awesome hippy-dippy little wedding in 1973. It's just, oh, Flower Children's City, you know. And he's got bell bottoms on about this wide, you know, and long hair down to his shoulders. And I've got my hair all piled up, and I've got flowers in my hair, and I've got on the white gauze dress. And we've got the guy strumming the guitar playing Strawberry Fields Forever. And we got married in the woods. And so you don't think I'm pure as a driven snow. After what I've told you previously, everybody at the, oh, I carry a big bouquet of daisies, and everybody at the reception gets a daisy and a doobie. It was, oh, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. And we took our honeymoon on the motorcycle, and when we got back, we packed up our 65 Rambler, our three little kids, and our dog named Narc, and we got the motorcycles in the U-Haul. And we headed for California. We looked like the grapes of wrath. I mean, we got stuff tied to the roof. And I was never a happier person in my lifetime. I got to come to California. He got hooked up with some bikers out here. And we rode, and we had so much fun. It was everything. It was all good. And we had another baby, a boy, because that's all I know how to do is have boys. So everything seems like it's going to be cool from this point forward, okay? And then when my third kid from my first marriage was 10 years old, he got in trouble for smoking pot in the boys' bathroom. And I got the call that day, and I'll tell you what, I was furious. Anger is my biggest tool, or at least anger and sarcasm were my two big tools. And I was very, very upset. And when he came home, I just beat the living tar out of him that day. I'm a child abuser as well. I just got an overwhelming rush from that. Not a good one. In any case, that was the beginning of a huge downward spiral for us that included both of us and our children. Joe, like I said, was 10 at that time, and by the time he was 12, we had put him in a behavior modification program because we weren't willing to say that we thought he had a problem with drugs or alcohol. Things were becoming obvious. I mean, the neighbor lady is screaming at us because there's graffiti on her fence, and my son says he didn't do it, and she says, I saw him do it, and he called her a lying bitch to her face, and, you know, we're there. We believe, we want to believe, the problem has gone away each time there's a sober period. We are walking pictures of Al-Anon literature, understanding ourselves. In any case, so we pay to have the fence, you know, sandblasted and all of that. And then it continues. And so he's in that program. He comes home $40,000 later with no big book. And by the time he's 13, he's been removed from our home by the County of Los Angeles and put in a camp out near Valencia, Camp Joe Scott. And by the time he's 16, and at this point, anything can happen in my house that doesn't bring the cops. I don't want to talk to the police anymore. I am on a first name basis with the juvenile detective in Gardena. You know, hi, John. Hi, Kathy. We're in your house with the canine squad, and we broke down your front door, so your house is not secure. You probably want to come home. Okay, John, be right there. You know, and I turn to the boss, and I say, I have to run home for a bit. You know, I'll be back. I'll be back, you know, and just it's a never ending nightmare. And I get to the point where I'm sitting on the north end of the sofa in my orange terry cloth house coat every single night, looking at the paper, just waiting to see what the hell's going to happen in our house tonight, you know. And it continued to get worse. 6'2" giant men with full beards come in my house and stop a few minutes in my son's room and leave. And I say, who was that? No, it's a school chum. No, no, no. It can't be a school chum because you don't go to school. No, we take you to school and you beat us home. Don't tell me it's a school chum. So anyway, it continues and it continues. And by the time he's 16 years old, he's hopelessly addicted to an outside issue. And I come home a couple of weeks before Christmas in 1986, therefore the 25th birthday tonight. And he tells me that he's got a bad habit and he needs to help, and can I do something? And he's going to kill himself because he owes somebody some money, and if he doesn't pay them the money, they're going to kill him. And I jump in the nearest phone booth and put on my superwoman outfit, and I say, hold everything. You know, I'll take care of it. Call the guy and tell him to come over. And we wrote him a check. Wrote him a check for $1,000 to a drug dealer. How many drug dealers do you know that'll take $1,000? To take any kind of check, 50 cents, let alone $1,000. And we wrote it to cash because his name was Mad Bull. And it was a nightmare. It was a nightmare. But I went to work and I said, I need some time off. I got to stay home with my kid. There's bad stuff happening. And I explained it to my boss and she said, Kathy, can I tell the manager? And I said, please tell the manager. And so she did. And he called me into his office and he said, he thought he could help my family. And the miracle began there for our family because he had 25 years, 20, I'm sorry, he had 16 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was sober. And he sent us to a facility in Tucson, Arizona, where they taught us all about the disease concept and how everybody in the family is affected. They sent our son down there, and I don't even want to tell you about the issue at the airport where it looked like there was a kidnapping taking place because I didn't want him to go. And Les was pulling me off the plane, and he was pushing Joe on the plane. Anyway, 28 days later, down there we went. And at the end of that 28 days, they sentenced us to Al-Anon. And so we showed up in our first Al-Anon meeting on January 3rd, 1987, and it was in a hospital. The room was set up in a square. Smokers on this side, non-smokers on that side. We were non-smokers. We went to that side, and I gave the stink eye to all those smokers over there. In a hospital, for cripe's sakes. You know, I just... And when they said, are there any newcomers? I raised our hand. And they said, introduce yourself by your first name. And I said, my name is Kathy. This is my husband, Les. This is my son, Jeff. This is my son, Mark. And this is our friend, Tony, from down the street who wants to participate in our recovery. There were two twin ladies, and many of you know them, Chris and Kathy, sitting directly across the table from us, and literally their eyes rolled back in their head. And for those of you who know Larsine, her husband Butch says that when she came home that night, she said, there was a real squirrel there tonight. And I wear that proudly. I wear that proudly. I love that. And so that was the beginning of our trip in Al-Anon. And I'd love to be able, our youngest son joined Alateen, and I'd love to be able to tell you that, you know, Les and I joined Al-Anon, and Jeff joined Alateen, and we just went tripping down the road of happy destiny together. That Joe came home sober, and that I'd love to be able to tell you that, but that's not what happened. Okay, so Joe came home and was sober for a minute, and then he went back out, and he stayed out. And then Mike, our oldest son, 90 days after we had been to Tucson, went belly up in his spaghetti one night And I said, what's going on with him? The other ones are going, Mom, he works at that medical place. He steals drugs all the time. I was like, okay. The next morning, he was on the plane to Tucson. And we were back down there with 90 days of Al-Anon. I knew everything there was to know, and I was willing to participate in telling you how to do it. And so he came back home. He didn't stay sober either. So 10 years after I'm in Al-Anon, after I join Al-Anon, and I have a sponsor and I'm working the steps and all of the good stuff that goes with the program, and I've been able to detach some, Joe gets arrested and is extradited to the state of Kentucky and is for interstate drug trafficking and conspiracy for murder for hire and is sentenced to 22 and a half years in federal prison. And that's currently where he is. He's currently in federal prison. However, he chose sobriety 8 years ago. And I want to share briefly with you the birthday card that we got from him. It says, Dear Mom and Dad, hey, I just wanted to say how proud I am of you both for giving it your all in this program. You've been great examples for me, and you've shown me an unconditional love that not too many people know. So I thank God for his work in your lives, because it has had a profound effect on me and my life, only for the best. Can't wait to be out to celebrate with you, but I send my love and prayers and good energy to you this month for your anniversary. Love you too, always Joey. So that's a turnaround. That's a bit of a turnaround from where he was when he went in. Mike got sober after we were in the program 10 years, and so he has 14 years of sobriety today. And before I have to wrap it up, which is pretty darn quickly here, I want to tell you about my mom and dad, because this is amazing to me. I never thought that those two people loved each other, and I thought they ought to get the heck away from each other, but they didn't. They just tortured each other until the end. And but my mom had Alzheimer's disease, and in the last 3 years of her life, she was in bed. And my dad decided that last year in 1986, just before I came to Al-Anon, to give her a 40th wedding anniversary party because he knew there wouldn't be a 50th. And so he had the party that alcoholics have, you know. The entire original wedding party was there. The flower girls were 50 years old. And he had 100 people and an open bar and the whole nine yards. And he spent a lot of time telling people how many times a day he had to change my mother's diaper and how he had to feed her through a tube. And I was furious with him. I had not yet come to the program. And I thought, you ought to, you SOB. How many times did I see her clean up your puke? I was furious. So anyway, somebody took a video of that night and gave me a copy of it, and I brought it home and stuck it on a shelf. We didn't have a VCR. And so the following year, I joined the program. My mother passes away when I was in the program just a month less than a year. And when I went home for her, no, not her funeral, 3 years later, he passed away. And when I went home for his funeral, there was no money left for his final expenses. And so we had to auction off all their belongings. He had drunk up everything and auctioned off all their belongings. And after we paid the final expenses, you know, we divvied up the rest of the money, my two sisters, my brother and I, and we each got $147. And I thought, what can I do with this $147 that'll remind me of my dad? Because I had made my amends to my dad, and we were clean when he died. And I thought, you know, he's a movie lover. I can buy a VCR, and then we can watch movies. And when we do, we can think of Mom and Dad. And so I bought the VCR, brought it home. Les hooked it up, and then we're going, we have no movie. And the kids remembered that there was the movie from Grandma and Grandpa's anniversary in the cupboard. So we got it down. We put it in. And it was not the same party I had been to. Seriously. I mean, these two people don't even like each other. And here, people are clinking the glasses, you know, for the bride and groom to kiss. And my dad is gently taking my mother's face in his hands and turning it towards himself and kissing her on the lips. You know, and then it comes time to cut the cake. And he puts the cake knife in her hand and pushes it down through the cake and takes a piece of cake, puts it in her hand, and smashes it in his own face, you know. And then I noticed my mom's got shrimp on her plate, and all the rest of us had roast beef. My mom had shrimp because she would eat shrimp. So no, there wasn't a whole lot of kissy face huggy bear going on in our house, you know, but there was love there that I couldn't see. And I believe I couldn't see it because of the disease of alcoholism. My eyes were clouded by my father's alcoholism, by my first husband's alcoholism, by my children's alcoholism. And then I came to you guys, and you gave me that new pair of glasses we talk about, and you know, the cloud was removed. And today I can see love, and I can feel love, and I can be loved, and I can give love, and I love all of you. Thanks for letting me share.